Oh yeah?
I'm amazed that I've used it, and I've never had to replace the battery. I don't understand that. Huh. Maybe it's queer touch. not every Sunday, but when I remember, I'll take it to my pocket to Mass, because we've got such a gorgeous paid choir, and record the prelude or whatever, and some of their service in it.
Yeah.
Have them on my iPod to listen.
So we're here with Louis Crew Clay. Excuse me. This is Timothy Stewart Winter and Whitney Strew on November 19th, 2015. Do you want to?
Sure. Just to get the ball rolling. Normally we would ask a full life history for the Queer Newark Oral History Project, but both because Louis is recovering from surgery and we don't want to take your whole day up, and also because Louis just published this fantastic book, Letters from Samaria, which I think we'll talk about a little more and certainly provide a link because we want people to read it. It's such a great history. But that tells so much of your history about, your youthful experiences, your struggles with identity and sexuality up to the age of 28, your early years with Ernest in rural Georgia as an interracial couple who's married in Atlanta in 1973, I believe. Sorry. 74.
Not in 73, though.
Okay, yeah, that's... It's a powerful book. I mean, it's so fantastic, and we really recommend it. But for the sake of this interview, we're going to cut in with your entrance to Newark and really focus on your experiences and memories and perceptions. And so maybe to get the ball rolling, you could just tell us when and why and how you arrived in Newark and your early perceptions of the city.
Well, I arrived in Newark in the summer of 1989. I was hired by the Academic Foundations Department, which is a developmental department, trying to take the brightest people who had survived the worst living conditions in Newark and surrounding areas and give them an intensive course in how to present their intelligence. We always started out with the intelligence was not something we were going to give them, something they brought to us, and we had great respect for it. And I really love that program, and I worked in that department for the fall of 91 or 92, and then I went to the English department.
And this is at Rutgers?
Yes.
And so you moved in fall 89. Where'd you live in Newark?
I lived on the in the North Ward on Mount Prospect Avenue. Right near Valentine Parkway, which goes down into Branch Brook Park. A lovely place to live and greatly diverse community. I lived first in a high rise of 12 floors. It was way too expensive, however. And when Ernest was still living in Hong Kong, finishing a commitment, actually in China at the time, in Guilin. And so when he got back, he found us a much more reasonably priced place, two doors down, no Tudor place, an apartment building, and we lived there until 89 here.
And can you say a little can you say a little about the campus environment at Rutgers Newark for LGBTQ students and faculty and staff at the time?
Well, I would say it was capricious. There were just pockets of great support, but it was like a minefield in trying to find them. Mm-hmm. I also felt very much that some of the things that were hostile were culturally induced but not emotionally invested in. I'll give you an example. I became, because of my interest in computers, I sneaked one of the first portable computers into China, for example, calling it a Hollywood typewriter, not a spy machine. Because of my interest in computers, I became very good friends of a member of the computer science department, and so I was on their mailing list. I would often have questions and would share. This is a staff mailing list, and I often taught my classes. I got very early, almost all the work turned into me on computers, so that I could give a make full use of my editing skills to a faster speed. Well, at one point I had told Bob offline, not on purpose to be offline, just had told him that I had been invited to speak to a class by someone else, which I preferred to do this in other people's classes rather than my own, to talk about gay issues and to take any questions that they might have. And I'd had a very good session with the class, so I told him about it. I didn't realize that I had mistakenly replied to all rather than just to Bob. Mm-hmm. So this went to all, which was no big deal, except for one young man. Very handsome, young African-American guy who wrote back, "What do you mean, faggot? Why are we having faggots in this discussion group, etc.?" Well, because Rutgers had one of the earliest anti-harassment statements about gays and lesbians in the country, largely because of the work of Jim Anderson down in New Brunswick, who was head of the library school and a good friend, and also one of the persons most connected with the starting of the Presbyterian Lesbian and Gay Group nationally. They were prepared, and Bob was talking in terms of getting this guy expelled, or at least suspended. I said, "No, just let me meet with him." I guess I don't know what they thought I was going to do to him. But I mean, why don't we, this is an educational institution. And when we met, one of the first questions I asked him, he was already quite chagrined.
This is a student?
Yeah, the student. And Bob insisted on being there. I would have preferred not having him there, but later I guess that was a pretty good idea, given the institutional misinterpretations that might otherwise have been made. I asked him whether he had any gay friends. And said, "Not that I know of." I think he then mentioned somebody he knew that was gay. He said, "Well, did he ever try to harm you?" "Oh, no, he was a really nice guy." He started thinking, he just became really aware that what he was doing in responding to this was simply a knee-jerk cultural response from his culture. I said, "Well, that's all right. That's where your culture is. But you're in another culture now. You may not have to get rid of your culture, but you got to learn how to survive in this one." I said, "Your first job may be with a very strong lesbian. And you're not going to do very well in that job if you bring this kind of attitude to the work." This is a kind of simple education. And he went back to work so glad that I was so nice to him. Later, someone threatened me with murder. It was a student who had come into the lab where my class was using, because I was following them all on a monitor and not much was being said. He sat down and took one of the positions. Well, since one was available, fine. But I had access to his computer as well. And then at that point, I thought, well, this isn't wise. So I asked him to leave and explained that this was a class. Well, then he sent me an email threatening to murder me. Not knowing, of course, that I had ways of, he had masked who he was, but I had ways of finding out because I could read the headers. I know something about messages. And they ended up dismissing him. And at the University Senate, when I worked in the University Senate, I said, what we need here is not firing people. If we're not getting people with these attitudes, we're not teaching the right people, because this is Northern New Jersey. And believe you me, these are the attitudes in Northern New Jersey, overwhelmingly. And I said, what we need to be concerned about is what are their attitudes, and more important, what are their behaviors when they leave here? I don't care whether they love me or not. I just care about proper civil behavior. And that didn't sit very much. So that'll give you a taste, enough of a taste.
So were there many other out faculty or staff members at the time?
James Creedle was the major leader of it, and did a wonderful job. He was a dean, worked in student services, and so he was not as threatening in terms of an academic status as a faculty member. There were some people who were known to be gay and lesbian, some of whom are still involved in the queer group, but not a very visible presence.
Yeah. And then what about students?
Students tended to be, and James Creedle was my source of information early on about this, but I wouldn't want to fault him for my reduction of it this many years later. But students tended not to go to the campus for their gay life. we are only, what, 20 minutes mm-hmm. away by Midtown Direct. Mm-hmm. And it just made sense with them, especially in some of the more hostile departments like business mm-hmm. and nursing mm-hmm. and so on. Made sense for them to have their social life divorced from their other social life. It's not a sexual life mm-hmm. in any definitive way. But and then in an integral way it is. That's been a very helpful distinction for me. I see my sexuality not as defining me, but as integral to who I am. So if you want to understand who I am, then you need to know it. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't define me any more than my being green-eyed or left-handed. Mm-hmm.
Did you have gay friends or other folks you knew in your
community? Oh, yes, and because I was out. I mean, even though I did not intentionally talk about gay issues much in my class, I always made a point, and sometimes I would forget and have to do it in the last week, to come to say, oh, my gay husband and I, my husband and I saw the same thing you're talking about, and give him an example. And I later found out from some of the students that one of the reasons I had a high class attendance was that they wanted to be there on the day that I would do this. They were already waiting for this to happen. It was kind of like, watch the pearl drop. So, I mean, there was this positive sense about it, too. Mm-hmm. And I would say, in terms of quantifying, yeah, the positive is always more ubiquitous than, well, you can't be more ubiquitous, approaching ubiquity more than the hostility. Mm-hmm. But the hostility defines you. The same thing about terrorism in the world. I mean, I don't think I need to go any farther. The parallel is so obvious.
And what about off campus? Were there gay bars or clubs in Newark?
I'm not a bar person.
Fair enough.
And bars are places to me that you go to when you're waiting for your dinner table to be opened up, or where you're going to the theater in a few minutes and you're getting a libation. Also, I don't like smoke in almost all of the bars. Certainly the two gay bars in Newark at that time were smoke-filled to the point that you needed to have your sweater dry cleaned just by going there. And
Which bars were these?
One was Murphy's, mm-hmm. And then another one was, I've forgotten what it was. It was way out on Ferry Street near the cinema complex, right before you get to the cinema complex. I'm not even sure the cinema complex is still there, which had originally been a drive-in. It's right opposite you don't see it at the time, right opposite the Newark Airport, the north side.
So out Ferry Street towards the airport.
Yeah.
Not the Cactus Club? That was closed by then, right?
That was closed by then.
Okay.
Huh. I've forgotten the name. I would recognize it.
Yeah, we'll have to fact check.
Huh. But I mean, I have records of every dollar I spent. My mother was head teller at the bank, so I mean, all these records, and I could document how many times I went to Murphy's, probably no more than 6 or 7, and always because somebody had arrived in town and wanted to see it. Mm-hmm. And the other one because it was so much farther away. And also because both of those places did not have a really obvious gay presence until after I was already going to bed. Mm-hmm. I mean, Murphy's was a good Irish pub in the middle of the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It may still be, I don't know.
No, it's gone now.
It's gone. It's gone.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a parking lot now.
Okay.
So what about other kind of gay social life in Newark?
Oh, well, I'm the rector of my church, many members of the parish, many members of the neighborhood. I had more opportunities for social interaction than I would have ever had. Suppose if I were into wanting sexual partners, which I wasn't, I was in here, very big cruising area in Branchburg Park, which was pretty obvious when you went by. And I was a jogger, so certainly I always liked to look. But I didn't have any problem there at all. But most of my social life, which is fairly limited anyway, a lot of my social life is social media. I was doing social media before the name came along. I created the first list of bishops and deputies to the General Convention of the Episcopal Church. I could only get about, I actually got the figure somewhere, that it was a very limited number of people. When I became a deputy the first time, and, I think I started in about 91, before I became a deputy, 94 I was a deputy. And by the time I left, I had still gone. It's a huge, I don't go to it anymore because I'm not active in that. I haven't gone since I actually became more a member of the executive council, which is the governing body, core governing body of the church. I didn't have time. But no, I just, and it was like you had to, and I remember at Rutgers, it was so hard to get anybody on the faculty to use email or the computer resources. And when they found out I was doing it, they thought I was just playing games. And they didn't realize that you could do wonderful intellectual things, especially in composition. I mean, my goodness, it shouldn't be about talking about writing. It's like learning about classical music by talking about the composers. It's like Presbyterians taking over NPR and talking, only talking about it. You know, you ought to listen to the damn music. You know, let it get to you. Music has a language of its own. And it just, so anyway, I got worked up on that. But I was quite involved. I loved it in China, too, when I was teaching in Hong Kong. There was no internet. But students always had to bring copies of anything they wrote for my classes, and they wrote something every day. They brought a copy of the disc to me and a copy to at least two other people in the class. Because if they're writing for me, they're willing to take a lower grade. You know, but if you're writing for somebody else, you want it to. You might want the wrong thing. Someone spent hours on their fonts and little on what they wrote. But, you know, this is the greatest revival of epistolatory composition since the 18th century.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
No, that's
a good way to think about it.
And the other thing that's particularly nice, if you want to find out new language study, for example, I created, I think I was the first one in the world to do it, the word lesbier.
Which you use in the book.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, trans kind of came in and railroaded it away. Lesbier trans, it begins to get too long. It was a word of utility. And that was, well, I could go online and, for example, Gaynet, all of that stuff from the whole beginning is still on the user group. It's still online to go back and research. You can trace, in fact, I wrote an article like tracing the use of that term and the increased use of that term. Of course, it's not used at all anymore.
Right.
But just to take a neologism like that or anything else, and you want to see what people are calling themselves. It's just fascinating what you can do. You can have a freshman class in Bible as literature, for example, doing things. I always try to arrive early in my classes because I can have personal conversations. Mm. And usually I'd go in as soon as the other teacher got out of the room. And there was some young woman with a nose ring, and she was so happy about the assignment. I said, why? She said, oh, I just love this assignment. They gave Rebecca a nose ring as a gift to get her to be the bride of Isaac. And she went on and on about it. She's going to tell her mother to leave her alone about her nose ring. It's in the Bible. And I said, well, what are you going to write your next paper on? Because I always had them do a prospectus, and they had to get my approval, because you can identify 95% of them are going to be stolen. So this way, I wouldn't approve anything that could just be lifted out of something. And I wanted to learn how to do research. And they have access to the Bible with electronic text. I said, well, we worked it out. She did a study of jewelry in the Old Testament. And it grew into, now there are people who've written about that. But because she had already invested, I said, go in there, don't just take this out. Argue with some of these people. Well, this was a great way to teach composition, because the texts are teaching, her mind is engaged in doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay, when you moved to Newark, the kind of anchors of your life were Rutgers, your parish,
and the diocese. particularly.
And the diocese.
I spent more time at work in the diocese than in my parish.
Okay.
My parish was sort of like a refueling station.
And were there, and you were out at the diocese?
Oh, yeah.
And what was that like?
Well, we had the most supportive bishop in the whole Anglican Communion. It was the Bishop of Newark, Jack Spong.
Jack Spong,
and
right.
I mean, and when I came up for my interview in March for the job that I had that summer and had all the way through.
Your job?
Yeah, we're teaching at Rutgers.
At Rutgers.
They put me up at the Hilton, Gateway Hilton, and Jack Spong, and I let him know I was coming, and he had me at his, he was courting a person who's been his bride since 2000, and he was having dinner at her house, had me coming, Bishop of Okuth, who was the Bishop of Uganda, was there staying as a house guest, and I went out there and had a wonderful exchange with her. It was just really, and Jack has never been one to like small talk, and he'll always ask you what we were saying earlier, the question you're not supposed to ask. Tell Ona here about being gay. And I said, well, first, Ona, how many gay people do you know? And there are no gay people in all of Uganda. I said, well, Ona, I know 6 Ugandan priests who are here in this country because it was so unsafe for them to say that they were gay in Uganda. And at that point, Uganda had the highest infection rate of AIDS. And higher than Newark's, which was huge. And 22% of all, according to an article that I would have my freshman read and then have to put into standard English, I mean into readable English, not that it's a medical ease. And 22% of all young men between the ages of 21 and 44 were tested positive by anonymous testing at the major hospital in Newark at that time.
Could you tell us more about AIDS in Newark?
Well, it was just devastating, and because there was so much dishonesty. And James Creedle was absolutely brilliant in his ways of handling it. James and I knew each other before I came here. James was a founder of a group called Black and White Men Together, which later became People of All Colors Together. And I was a keynoter for them very early. Adrian Rich and I were co-keynoters at one of their conventions. Then later, 15 or 20 years later, after I was at Rutgers, I was a keynoter again for them. But James and the people who work there realized you got to work through racism before you start just, because you can have sex in the darkness of the night, and nothing wrong with that, but my goodness, if you're going to have an organization that's going to carry you anywhere beyond the bedroom, you need to start dealing with humanities of each other and strict details. And so. Well, James also realized that people were using Branchwood Park, the great assignation place. Mm-hmm. You can ride by in the broad daylight and see guys screwing each other. Not mind the bushes, but right out, sometimes, not often, right out under one of the bridge things, whether you're driving under it. And James had a party one evening. Oh, it was so difficult for me to stay up to 11:30. That's when it started. Yeah. And it was like, what is the cult movie that so popular, the Birds of Le Cage aux Folles, which everybody would go to that when it first came out after midnight, dressed as one of the characters. But James had a coffee table that was probably 6 times as big as this, and on it he had what I would call the Baptist altar cloth cover, just a sheet. You pick it up, and instead of finding communion cups and wafers, he found sex toys. And he already had some already arranged to pick up a huge dildo and throw it to this one over here who wasn't expecting it. And just to play with it in public. And these are people who might have played with their own thing in public, even of sort. And then to talk about the message of that whole evening was life-saving more than, I would have to say, more than any Baptist sermon or Episcopal sermon I've ever heard. If you love yourself, you won't have unsafe sex.
Mm.
That saved lives.
Yeah.
I decided at one point to send a letter to 8 or 10 of them. Went to the library and got the sergeant's directory of all the private schools in the country. I picked out 8 or 10 of the best named ones in New Jersey. got invited to about five of them. One of them was the Petty School, which is way out in Brightstown, I know. Anyway, way out in wonderful rural America. And the chaplain was going to invite me, but he was afraid to do it. So the historian invited me. The chaplain came afterwards. They had a little reception for me. He said, "You were saving lives in there." He made certain I got invited back about 8 years later.
You spoke about HIV prevention?
What I did was to come into the class and I said, "I will never be invited back here, so let me just have some fun with you. I want to give you a fantasy. Close your eyes. And I'll leave them open so you can see." I said, "I want you to imagine that you're in a room with a person of the gender that most attracts you. And that person is in bed with you, and you're both naked." I said, "Do you like that? Think about that for a minute. Look at all the parts, even the parts that usually are covered. Uncover them. You like that fantasy? You know?" I said, "Well, go for it. Touch that person. You like that fantasy? You know?" I said, "Now the person reaches underneath and pulls out a gun and opens it up for you and shows you the chambers and says, none of them are loaded. Take this gun, and if you love me, you'll trust me, you gotta trust me. And you take the gun and put it to my temple and fire." Everybody's looking at me so strange. I said, "What's wrong with this picture?" And I told them the rate of infection. I said, "This chamber is not free. One out of four or one out of five. Let's count them off. One, two, three, yes. One, two, three, four, yes." I made them go all the way around the room. I mean, it was a very wonderful moment. At another point, I decided to tease one. I said, "All right, who's the most Don Juan-like character in the room?" And everybody started pointing at the same guy. I said, "I mean, he really flirts a lot, doesn't he? All that, yeah." I said, "Well, young man, they've just volunteered you. Come on up here." And they came up and shook his hand, but I didn't let go. Looked around. I ran my finger down into his palm. Hopefully so as many people could see. I said, "What am I doing?" He didn't say. I said, "I'm running my finger down his palm." I said, "Have I done anything sexual yet?" He said, "No." And I said, and I did a couple of other playful things. But he's looking very disturbed because he's used to being in control. And everybody in the audience is giggling and enjoying this immensely. And then I said, "Well, why don't you come up and look at my etching? And let's have some fun." He said, "No." I said, "Well, thank you. Because you're not really invited to that. I have a husband, and I don't want to do that either." But he said, "When did that ever become sexual? All those other things that you're so disturbed about in the room, for the whole room. What was that kind of thing?" So, I mean, I was, and I did some of that in classes. Again, tried not to do it in my own classes because I had other things for them to write about. But I was always interested as a composition teacher, and I realized most people in the English department did not do this, but I was, you know, senior. I could go and do what I wanted. I felt that the major job here is to learn how to write, not to be writing necessarily some paper that you just simply run over and read scholars on scholars on scholars on one writer.
Well, can I do a follow-up question about HIV in Newark? In Letters from Samaria, you've got this great essay, Barry and Me and the Angels, which was published.
It's a true story, yeah.
It was published in Christianity in Crisis in 1992. And you talk about this young man. Barry was 28, brilliant, black. He and his Puerto Rican lover were together for 8 years before the lover died, which sent Barry on this downward spiral. And he wound up in a bed in a shelter for people with AIDS, the only one in all of Newark. And you write this, and I want to hear more about this. You write, "The shelter was for HIV-positive drug addicts, most of them macho straights who, quote, knew or know how to handle a sissy." And so this was the only HIV/AIDS shelter in Newark, and it sounds violently homophobic. And I wonder if you could just talk more about that. Like, how did that come to be, and where did men like Barry go then?
I'm sorry, I don't know that I ever did know who created it. I don't think it was church. Most of the churches in Newark, and most of the funeral homes in Newark would not knowingly bury anyone who had AIDS. Mm. I'll tell you more about that in a bit.
Yeah.
But I remember driving him home one night, and clearly wanted me to at least play with him. I wasn't.
You know, Barry, this is.
Barry, yeah. And taking him back to that shelter.
Mm.
From where?
I think maybe we had been at a friend's house.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very good friend of somebody whose name will come up in some of your research, Derek Winans,
mm-hmm.
Who was at odds with James Creedle. And Derek was a Harvard graduate and an African-American lover and was in a very prominent family, a very wealthy family, but sort of got disowned by them. Well, they had come bury him in my parish. But he was a cussed, wonderful old guy, and he was the one that introduced me to Barry, so that's probably where, yeah.
Derek is the one who introduced you to Barry.
Yeah, I think so.
Where was this shelter?
When you go down Martin Luther King Drive all the way down to Springfield Avenue, and you've got that old Daddy Divine Hotel there.
Mm-hmm.
It was near there.
Do you remember the name?
I don't. Sorry.
Can you describe it a little? Just to sort of flesh it out and make
it
more...
I didn't go in there. So
no.
I just took him out, so I don't really remember. Just a storefront.
But so gay men who read as gay would want to avoid that place because of...
Well, I guess
sort of...
if you needed some help, you know, and you're cold enough and need food or shelter, you'd go there.
Mm.
Yeah.
You heard about the conditions from Barry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But much of the article that you were just reading from is about his, when I went to visit him in St. Michael's Hospital. Which
yeah.
is right there, opposite Newark, main opposite Rutgers, yeah.
And then he died
yeah.
very shortly
yeah.
thereafter.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the issue of AIDS and burial services?
Yes. The dean of our Episcopal Cathedral, St. Trinity and St. Philip's, there on Military Park, which we'll have to move if they ever make that steeple anything but white. Interesting thing in the arena. I was a Dodgson historian for a while. Sabuni was a Ugandan, or is Ugandan, and one of the nicest human beings on the planet. His wife was one of the founders of the St. Philip's Academy, which is one of the best schools in the area. And Sabuni told me very early on that he was having, he had done a burial for somebody that didn't really want to have, and somebody who died in the parish or in the cathedral, and they didn't want to do the funeral. I think this was at the Perry Funeral Home, but I'm not really sure, because that's where they ended up burying Barry as well, but Sabuni, this was before that, Sabuni went around to the various funeral homes and he told me this. He said, look, you have to bury these people. They had realized by law by this time, but if you have anybody that has no one who will come to the funeral, I will do it. You may have to wait on me, and if you're waiting on anyone from your Uganda, you'll wait forever because they have a different clock. And I mean that with great respect, because he'll stop and help everybody on the way getting there.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the story. It was just really awful.
Yeah, no, it's it. And so I know there was a lot of underreporting of AIDS fatalities in the media. There'd be a lot of euphemisms or evasions. So when somebody like Barry died, I mean, would there be an obituary? And if so, did they identify him as an AIDS-related death?
I'm embarrassed to say, because in my youth and up to about 40, I read obituaries all the time. It was one of my favorite things to do, to understand my community in a great way, because it's a little composition that everybody writes, you know. But I have not done so during this period. So. I don't really know about the obituary. But my guess is that few did.
Yeah, that's my sense.
And I know that one young man who was just a member of the Black and White Men Together group from Newark, who was a reporter for the Star Ledger and quite a good one. I forgot his name, you know. But he died of AIDS. Yeah, James Cradle said that he had one of the best collections of good gay erotica, I mean, like really fine paintings of anybody that he had ever known. And he wasn't sure, but he thought the family probably burned them all.
Wow. Would James remember his name?
Ask him.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
This is someone who was in the Black and White Men Together group.
Yeah.
Could you tell us about that group?
The group...
did you join?
I joined shortly after it started, but I was not living near enough to go to any of the meetings, except in Milwaukee, but it was when I was in Stevens Point. And I did go to some in Milwaukee and spoke to the groups there. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got in on their circuit, so to speak. But I also wrote for their publication occasionally.
But in Newark, you weren't as connected?
Not a meeting as such in Newark.
Got it.
The Newark folks all met in the Gay Center, mainly, Manhattan, at least the ones I went to. I got so spread out that I realized I can't do anything if I go to everything. So.
Sure.
So I did more and more of the integrity stuff at one point.
I want to come back to integrity, but just to follow up a thread that we started a minute ago, can we talk a little bit more about Derek Winans, who's somebody I'm very interested in, who's not with us to speak.
Derek was a splendid community organizer.
Mm.
I don't know what he majored in Harvard, but he was brilliant anyway. And I was quite surprised, frankly, he was so neurotic. So neurotic. Driving me crazy to be around him for half an hour. I thought I was in a Tennessee Williams novel that even Tennessee had thrown away.
Was he Southern?
No, Derek was very much New Jersey.
But neurotic.
Neurotic.
Or neurotic.
Like he took it out of coinage on it. But at his funeral at Grace Church, they packed the church and he held 600 people. I wouldn't say it's absolutely full, but it was bigger than we can get for most Easters and Christmases. And we got good crowds. He was much beloved because of his service in writing grant proposals, rather.
Huh.
He was a master at getting grants.
For
which you need for your programs, too. Everybody needs.
Yeah. And he ran the People with AIDS Coalition in Newark. Were you involved with that? Do you have memories of that? Because it seems like it was a short-lived group, but I'm not exactly sure about that.
All I sensed was that there was a battle for hegemony between the Winans group and the Treadle group. And the Creedle group. Obviously should ascend because it was a larger community of representing the complexion of, and I say that with three of us, not the complexion of the community. It would have been, in my mind, so much nicer if they could have joined.
So why? What was the
I can't give you the dynamics. Because frankly, I'm a conflict avoider when I don't need to be involved in the conflict, especially when I don't see a role for myself. Now, I love both those guys, and I wanted to continue to love both those guys.
Mm.
Even if Derek did piss in my car on the seat every time I took him here. Poor
piss?
Guy, he had a prostate problem.
Oh.
And when he didn't use the pins.
This is when he got, when he was ill and dying, or?
I know it was well before.
Well before, okay. And do you remember his, he had AIDS, right?
I've always assumed Derek did, but.
Oh, not clear.
I've
okay.
never been,
not
never
for
had
sure.
that clearly stated, and he told me no. I didn't ask him at one point, because his lover died of AIDS.
Okay.
But Derek lived until, 2004?
Something like that,
Well
beyond. And I think Al died probably in the 90s,
Can you talk about Al a little? He's also a really fascinating figure.
He was, as I recall, a clothes maker and a good designer.
Mm-hmm.
I may be wrong on that. could as easily have been porcelain in my memory playing tricks on him. But he was an artist. I would say, have you seen this wonderful book by the guy named Johnson, Iced Tea? It's about black men.
Oh, yeah, Sweet Tea.
If you ever watch, Sweet Tea. If you ever watch any of the videos of him on YouTube, Johnson's a little nicer looking than Al was, but they have the same sort of wonderful prissy ambiance that I love. I work so hard on it, I can't.
Can I ask one more follow-up question to all of this then? I mean, by this period, Newark seems like a very racially segregated city, and yet you, James Creedle, Derek, and Al are all interracial couples.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little about how race worked here in sort of gay Newark?
Well, I think it worked, at least the one you just named, I know it worked at a personal level. Creedle went off from very rural, all-black community in South North Carolina to the Army.
Mm.
And the Army was very crucial to James's development.
Mm.
And he had friends there and had lovers there that were white. And he got treated as a human being in ways that sometimes even African-Americans have a hard time of not being racist themselves. And but James never abandoned his people, nor as Ernest. I mean, I've never felt that there was ever any sense that he... And I've been amazed in 41 years. I've never picked up on anybody ever even accusing him of trying to be white or whatever. And it's one of the reasons it was such a great moment, I can't mention it without crying, to be able to take his last name legally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's lovely.
Because, I've been a clay, been working and growing in one. I did covered rub off out and rubbed off. And I've never meant by that to deny my privilege, my whiteness, and my gratitude for my loving, wonderful parents. It's not that at all.
Well, that's fantastic. It also makes me wonder, I mean, were other gay social worlds in Newark more segregated? I mean, is there a white gay world, a black gay world?
I would ask you that. You're the one studying all these other worlds. I told you about the ones I know.
Okay, so your experience...
So you have done a good job of picking out somebody who would not have thought of telling you, for example, about the funeral homes and things like that. Yeah.
Okay. No, that's very helpful. I mean, it's counterintuitive in a lot of ways, I think.
Yeah.
What is?
Well, I guess, I mean, the suggestion is that, at least in your experience, gay Newark was not hyper-segregated racially the way that, like, residential patterns in Newark more broadly were.
No. Yeah. Well, there was some wonderful... One of the major events, too, that was a catalyst, I think, of building community in a stronger public sense was the murder of Sikia. And the fact that Cory Booker... I don't know whether you've seen the pictures I have of him on my website that I took of him standing there with that wonderful guy from that More Light Church or whatever it's called, at the same podium. Here he is, just a council member, and, you know, taking on this issue, and knowing that he's a bachelor, and knowing that there are all kinds of rumors about him, and still are, and also knowing that there are all kinds of rumors about the guy he needed to succeed. So, I mean, it's a whole big mess. It's like America. Like the Republican Party.
No, boy.
I mean, how many folks have they had and been exposed? I mean,
right.
So if you think about the Sikia Gunn murder, most of my, you know, my students who are from Newark grew up later. How was it different before, in the 90s, say? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think the fact that we had the parade, or the stand on the steps. And I remember Michael Francovilia, who was the chief administrator of the Diocese of Newark, and his partner Bill Lorenz, a lawyer for the state, were there with us. Carl Holland, the rector of my parish, and his lover, an AIDS specialist, doctor, physician, Timothy Mundy, were there. Ernest, and I don't think Ernest was there. Yes, I mean, he wasn't there, but anyway, this young people came up and said, "Why are you here?" And they mentioned that they'd been together Bill had been together at that time longer than, there would be so true, longer than we had.
Who had?
Bill Lorenz and Michael Franco Delia. And this was something like 35 or 40 years or whatever it was. Years, you know, their mamas weren't even born 35 years ago. And they were just amazed. And the fact that we were there. And the fact that we got them even at one point come down and use our space at Grace Church a block away. And I think the fact that not a whole lot, but significant number, nevertheless, of white gay folks and our allies came out and stood with us. The bishop came and others.
So the public, the willingness of people to be in public, is what I'm hearing. Yeah.
And that, one of the demands that they had at the time was to get a community center, which we now have, right?
So, can I shift back to another topic about religion in Newark?
Okay.
And another thing that comes out of your book, so Bishop Spong, I want to hear more about, because he looms pretty large over the history of sort of progressive religion in Newark. But one thing you mentioned in the book, which I hadn't known, is that he was, as you say, an unholy terror to gay priests in the 70s. And then at some point he comes around and becomes a very strong supporter and ally. Could you talk about that? Because I'm not familiar with that story.
The story he gives, and I think it's in Living in Sin, one of his books.
Okay.
I've certainly heard him tell it to me personally. And it's in one of the books, maybe in a couple of them. His wife had schizophrenia, and during the last years of her life, they had to live apart. She lived in their home in Morristown, and he lived in the carriage house behind the Dyson Center, which is now the horribly decorated thing for New Jersey PAC on Rector Street. Okay, there's a little carriage house behind what used to be the deanery, with the building that fronts the back of the cathedral. And he was mugged one night there as well, robbed. But when his wife died, the funeral was in Richmond. He had been the rector of the largest parish in Richmond. Here he is grieving. Hasn't been a good relationship at all. But they had, I think, 3 and maybe 4 wonderful daughters. And he is hurting so much at the funeral. And he comes outside, and I don't think the woman spat, but somebody came up and said, "You are the scum of the earth," or something. I'm not quoting her exactly. Something really hostile. And the integrity members of that parish who were gay came up and gathered around him and held him and prayed with him. Or some other show of the thing. He said it changed his life. How wrong could I be? And he's also, he's no dummy. He's a very bright guy. He's not what some people want to make him into being, nor does he claim to be. He's not the pioneering theologian. He is the popularist. Mm-hmm. And he's better at it than most people. And they're jealous as hell. Mm-hmm. And among the theologians and the ones who are afraid that he's getting more of a reputation than he deserves. But he deserves a reputation of being a great popularist, such as St. Paul, who was no great theologian either. God, I'd love to rewrite some of his sentences. But that was the transformation. And I met him shortly thereafter, his sort of Damascus Road experience. And there's a great picture on my website of the two of us, and Malcolm Boyd are sort of over in the corner, and somebody else, I don't know, outside in the shade. Break in the Integrity Convention of 1989. It was the summer. It would have been 89. The summer of 89. I came. I was already here, but went there for the convention or whatever. And it could have been the summer before, because that's how I knew to get in touch with him. And when I got the interview, and that's how we made the connection. It was almost like an answer to the needs of both of us. I don't know if we'd pray for it. We both ended up in the same community. And he was very close to John Boswell, John Bosley came close to me, and now John Bosley was a theologian, or historian rather, quite a good one. I'm fairly infrequent, but contact at least twice or so a year with his sister,
whose sister?
John Boswell's sister.
Yes.
I don't know whether that's enough answer to that.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. So your own religious sort of activism in Newark, could you speak more about that? Because, I mean, you're an incredibly important figure in, you know, the history of integrity and gay Episcopal politics, and I'm just wondering how that translated to Newark specifically once you were here. I mean, what resistance did you encounter, or conversely, you know, what acceptance did you encounter that you might have expected or not?
I did not try to organize anything in Newark.
Okay.
I've always felt like if something's already going, I mean, Jesus even talks about that they're not for me, they're against me. He says, if they're not against me, they're for me, the way he puts it. Jesus says also, I have other sheep, not of this fold, them I love also. I think that's everybody else, Buddhists and all the others, the whole world. I engaged myself where I thought it could be helpful and where also it could be helpful to me. And it so happened that Jack Spahn made a horrible mistake in his choice of persons to run the Oasis. Mm-hmm. He wanted this new ministry of the diocese with gay and lesbian people. And
which is called Oasis? That's what Oasis is?
That's what is Oasis. The first the second diocesan ministry, but the first one doing it this way. The first one was the parsonage in San Francisco, which was mainly an old house storefront place where they kept somebody on staff all the time to be there in the Castro, which was very good. It may still be going, I don't know. I think it folded for a while, but I think we ever arrived. The Oasis, Jack wanted to have a full-time missioner who would run it and be a priest and function at most respected levels, at the highest levels of the diocese. I'm sure he would have made a canon out of them as soon as he could. In fact, he did, Elizabeth Caton, who later got that job, with whom I'm having dinner tomorrow night. But Robert Williams, he wanted to find a really bright guy at a bar who's always going to be a bright guy and always at the bar, and who had a good notion of who God is, go to Robert Williams. But if you want somebody to help you work institutionally and to hold your back when you're up to fire, the last you need is some blowhard like Robert Williams, who when the press is there and he's asked about Mother, he makes the remark that Mother Teresa should have had a good lay.
Oh, God.
Well.
Can you imagine when the bottom drops out?
Wow.
This is, and I had just come on the board of the Oasis. I was Robert's pick, to be honest, because I just moved. I remember going to talk to Robert. This is not off the record, by the way. I mean, this is so long ago.
I'm just going to.
I remember going to talk to Robert, and saying, "Robert, here's what you could say by way of apology." Still respects, but I am a church politician. I don't know how to do it. And I had written something that I could say with great belief and show great respect for Mother Teresa and great respect for his real notion behind that wonderful remark. Because at the bar, it's a wonderful remark. And we all need to go to the bar once in a while. But I came back, he agreed to it. This was a telephone conversation to Hoboken from the diocesan convention, where we had been in a session throughout most of the convention, this little board of directors. Came in, and Cynthia Black, who is now, I guess this part should not be in any part, because she is a priest of the diocese, now Redeemer Morristown, a wonderful human being, said, "Louis, that's fine, but you wrote that, didn't you?" And Robert signed on to it. "I love you both. We can't take as Robert's what you wrote. And Robert's incapable of writing this or living it right now." So we fired him. It was a hard time.
Yeah.
We were lucky. We got David Norgaard.
When was this, by the way? I'm sorry.
This was right after I got here, sort of in the convention in 1990, January.
Okay.
And
continue.
David Norgaard came in. Then following David Norgaard, there was a short term of a monk who came in. It didn't work out that well. And then, which doesn't need to be said, and then Elizabeth Caton, who had done AIDS work as a nurse, who was a priest in Baltimore, and she was given canon status and is one of the leading figures in the Episcopal Church. She's retired now, retired from St. Paul's in Chatham. She lives in Long Neck, Delaware, down near Rehoboth, has been many times head of the Women's Caucus of the Episcopal Church, not only in the diocese, but overall. Quite a strategist. Tough lesbian Puerto Rican. She's been such an advocate for me in my illness, I can't tell you how grateful I am.
Yeah.
Just miracles have just dropped out. Supports come in, and things I've needed, I would really have been strapped to provide. Just amazing. She knows how to wither. Where the people are to go tap, and these angels appear and don't even have names.
Well, no, that's fantastic. So this is kind of out of the blue, and I think the answer might be no, but did you know Raymond Proctor in Newark at all?
No,
the
name.
Was that before your time? Okay. I thought it might have just missed. Tim, are you gearing up for questions?
Mm-hmm.
Can we stop by three?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, in fact, yeah, we want to watch your time and maybe...
Yeah.
I think we've actually covered all of the topics I was going to ask about. I mean, we usually wrap up by asking, what else should we be asking about? Like, what else should we put on the record for the Queer Newark Oral History Project?
I'm going forever. I walked myself into the tombstone. Actually, there won't be one of those. I'm going to be blowing in the wind. Not even a little jar.
But just thinking about the queer history of Newark, I mean, what else are we not thinking to ask you that we really should because you would be a good resource on?
I don't know. It occurs to me, there's some real questions about Hart Crane.
Yes.
And why the one book he wrote about gay prostitutes, the manuscript disappeared.
I don't know that story.
I don't know the details, but... Call up Ulysses Dietz over at the Newark Museum.
Yeah, we met him last year.
He was one of the presidents of
the
Oasis. He's a very, you know who he is in terms of his history of America. He's a great-grandson or great-great-grandson of the president. And he got to take his Jewish lawyer, husband, they got to adopt, adopted children. To an event that Reagan organized when he was in the White House of descendants of famous Americans. And they even had Robert E. Lee's great-great-great-granddaughter. Ulysses got to introduce Gary as his lover.
Wow.
I thought it was wonderful. I don't think I should tell his story by this tape, but I don't think you should.
I'm
going to ask Ulysses if you could tell him.
Yeah, that's a good thought, if someone to talk to.
Yeah.
Are there other people who... could tell us things about gay life in New York that we
haven't. I'm trying to think. His name is Warner. He's dead.
Warner.
He lived at Princeton. One of the original gay activists from a very wealthy family. He became blacklisted as a lawyer because he was exposed. I've forgotten his name. Kim Byam, my friend Kim Byam, was a historian and gay, and I can give you his telephone number. He'd be glad to tell you, because Arthur Warner, I think, was his name.
Oh.
But Kim...
I know that name.
Kim knows the story.
What's he got to do with...
Arthur Warner knew all the tricking places in Newark. And he even, I think, when he tried to have sex with me once, it was one of the nicest bits of flattery I ever got from anyone. He was about my age now, when this was 30 years ago. He said, well, I mean, look, Louis, he said, I had sex with so-and-so who had sex with Walt Whitman. If you'll just do that, you'll put yourself into a great daisy chain. I said, oh, sugar, that is so sweet. Well, thanks for no thanks.
That's quite a line.
Yeah. I remember a rabbi after I'd gone to a National Gay Task Force meeting in New York in 75. I was staying with someone in Brooklyn. I got the last train to Brooklyn. And I'd had a long wait, and this rabbi was busy trying to seduce me. And I said, but you're a rabbi, you can't be having sex with a man as with a woman. He said, honey, I won't have sex with you as with a man, not as with a woman. I thought that was one of the best exegesis I had.
So Arthur was knew all the tricking spots in Newark.
And lived in Princeton.
He lived in Princeton.
Yeah, and lived in the old family home. And knew everything.
He would come here to
cruise when he was a younger man.
Ah.
He once told me he got a, because he was on my mailing list, he probably even got notices about my book because of my mailing list.
Yes.
So I gave it to the publisher.
That's great.
But I gave it to, they were raising money for a Louis Crewe scholarship at EDS several years ago. Still have it. Some millionaire that looked like Colonel Sanders, who's gay. He was a brain surgeon, gave him the money to start the endowment. But Arthur got this thing from the Louis Crewe Endowment for a scholarship to EDS. That's Episcopal Divinity School on the right adjacent to the, right across from the Longfellow home, right adjacent to Harvard. And he started crying, talking to me, saying, I just got this thing. He said, Louis, don't you know my story about EDS? I said, no. He said, well, I was walking by one day because I was on my way to class, and the dean was in his study, and the study is in one of those windows that looks 2 feet away from you as you're walking by, you know, right there on the sidewalk. And he said, it just glared down at me what he knew who I was. And then later he said, I was invited by one of the seminarians to spend the night. He said, I spent the night. He said, of course, it's communal showers, and so I took a bath. Took a bath, came down, and the dean had me blacklisted or something. I said, oh, Arthur, I'm so sorry. I wish I'd known that. I would pull your email. He said, oh, no, I'm calling to thank you. It's so good to live to see this happen. I'm crying for joy, not for sadness. Isn't that wonderful? Yeah, I forgot that story. Thanks for the prompt.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
What are some more questions?
What about documents? I saw your papers are at the University of Michigan.
Called the Labadie Collection.
Oh, really?
Labadie was an anarchist.
Yeah, I know the collection.
And
your papers are there?
Yeah.
Why there?
Well, in 1980, I taught in Beijing from 84 to 85. I got offered the job at Rutgers. No, wait. That's not where you're getting this from. Yeah. No, I got offered the, I was teaching at Wisconsin. I got offered the job and took a leave of absence from the University of Wisconsin for 84, 85. I applied and got the job at the Chinese University. Mm-hmm. Which meant I had to resign from the University of Wisconsin. And we had inherited all my parents' furniture, much of which is in here, though a lot of this is Irma's stuff too, especially when he was working for Domain, a big furniture company. But we had to get rid of a whole bunch of stuff in a hurry. And I'm a pack rat, I never threw away anything. And with all the bat shit in the attic of that place in Stevens Point, it came out just under 2 tons of papers. And I realized that I could not sort through that in that amount of time. And I would throw away things that were important, keep some things that weren't. And so I listed these 4 or 5 Ivy League schools that I figured had the most money. And said, the only thing I want is for somebody to take all of it and keep it all until I die and allow me easy access to it. I said, and pay for the shipment to you and for shipments on an ongoing basis thereafter. I don't want any money for the collection or anything like that. Well, every one of those places sent back saying, this is a great idea, but we're not the ones you should have. The University of Michigan Labadie Collection just sent out a call for wanting to approve their collection in this area. It turned out that Edward Sullivan, I love that guy. Anyway, the guy who ran the collection.
Oh.
He is dead now.
Yeah.
He had a black lover, and he knew about us. He just jumped at the opportunity. They put a catalog on it for a year. It doesn't have a high priority now. It shouldn't. Julie Herrera.
Yeah, I've corresponded with her about other things.
Yeah.
Yes, I
hear. And she, when one of the Rutgers graduates I had in my queer course, did a documentary on me. He went to the Labadie Collection, spent I think a week out there, and they were just wonderful to him in getting him access to everything.
And you've shipped them material since then?
Not much now because it's all, I mean there's a lot, but it's all electronic. Mm. That was BC, before the computers. Mm.
Gotcha.
What about the documentary? Is that...
You want a copy? I'll give you a copy for it.
Yeah.
I think I just have one extra so you can copy it.
Sure. Copy and return it for sure.
I'll get that.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Well,
no, don't let me forget that when we get up to go.
Sure.
But I think I can put my hand on it fairly quickly. And I'll also, what was the other thing I was going to send you? I can even print out for you the OASIS description of the scholarship.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
Great. And you mentioned your friend Kim.
Kim Byam.
Byam.
Yeah, I've got his name.
We can follow up on that.
Yeah, I mean, we can do one of this.
Are we done? Are we?
Fine with me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Kim is a historian himself. He's a lawyer retired from the New York Power